Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Now, as in many years past, the conversation about affordable rentals remains the same. We don't have enough, and we need more. Kevin Carney has heard that talk for almost 40 years during his affordable housing development career in Hawaii. In 1997, he opened the Hawaii office of EAH, a nonprofit housing corporation. Recently completed EAH projects include the development of 192 units in Ewa and the rehabilitation of 119 units in Mililani. And while the nonprofit has almost 600 units in the pipeline, the target of affordability may be a little different than what some people may believe. Kevin Carney recently stopped by our studio, and we talked about what constitutes affordability now.
Affordable for what we do means 60% and below of the area median income. The affordable definition, according to HUD, is that you should not be paying more than 30% of your income for rent or a mortgage plus utilities.
To which many people are already rolling their eyes and laughing because so many people are already up at 50% or maybe even 60%.
Yes, and they have definitions for the various levels, whether you're overburdened or extremely overburdened with your housing payments.
So the idea of reality then, and how we have to adjust the reality that we all experience, what do we need to do to be able to get a much better reality check, if you will, about what affordability means?
Well, affordability means different things to different people, obviously, depending on how much you're making. And it's not just a housing issue. It's a complete socioeconomic issue, mainly having to do with the living wage. The living wage in Hawaii, according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition, I believe is something like $37 an hour. Now, how many people make $37 an hour? Very few, really.
Our median income is somewhere, what, around $40,000,
$45,000? The average median income for Honolulu, and these are statistics put out by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the median income for Honolulu, I believe, is somewhere around $87,000.
But across the state?
Across the state, it's different. It's by county. So Honolulu is the highest county, so on the outer islands, it would be somewhat less than that, but not a lot less. I don't know what the specifics are.
Suffice it to say that people simply are not able to afford the kinds of houses that they would like to have, and that there may not even be a rental that they can find. We've been talking about this for such a long time, and yet it seems that all the talk hasn't exactly yielded a great push to have so many more units built consistently, despite what perhaps the governor would like or what has happened in the county of Honolulu, other places across the state. It always seems that we are consistently behind the curve and likely to stay that way. Do you see any way out of that scenario?
Unfortunately, no. I think we're going to be behind the curve, if you want to define it that way, for a long period of time. We're just not producing enough housing overall at all income levels, number one. But the biggest need for housing, per all the latest studies, and I shouldn't say latest studies, these studies go back years and years and years. The greatest need for housing are for those at 80% and below of the area median income. So if the area median income for a family of four is roughly $87,000, so you're talking somewhere in the $60,000 range and below. Unfortunately, there's very little subsidy programs available. Government subsidy programs to help subsidize housing for those folks from 80% on up of the area median income. Below 80%, particularly between 80% and 60% of the area median income, there's a very limited amount of subsidy available. And that's one of the reasons why EAH works and serves those at 60% and below of the area median income, because that's where the largest amount of housing subsidies exist.
You're soon going to be speaking to lawmakers this week. What is it that you think that you'll be able to tell them that they'll be able to hear differently that may result in some better action?
I don't know that they're going to hear anything different from me.
Which is part of the whole issue that we've been talking about this for a long time. Is there going to come a point where we will be forced to do something simply because we won't be able to house people who are taking the jobs that are necessary for Hawaii to flourish?
I think that point may come. What they're going to hear from me is the same thing I've been preaching for a number of years now. I mean, I've been in this business for over 20 years now, and this situation as far as lack of housing and people applying for housing has just continued to get worse. We operate 18 properties on three islands here, over 1,800 units, and you know, we have waiting lines for all of our properties. What I'm going to say to the state legislatures is, you know, your organization, the state legislature, declared a housing crisis a number of years ago. I think it was in 2011. Since that time, we haven't seen any major increase in funding, subsidy funding, to help us achieve and produce more affordable rental housing. In addition to that, in the last couple of years, the state legislature put a cap on one of our major funding sources, which is the conveyance tax, which supplies funding to the Rental Housing Revolving Fund. And I don't want to get too deep in the weeds here, but the Rental Housing Revolving Fund is one of our biggest sources of gap financing. And the money that comes from the conveyance tax, we get 50% of that conveyance tax. So every time a property is sold or bought, there's a tax paid to the state. 50% of that tax goes into the Rental Housing Revolving Fund. I think it was 2 years ago that the state legislature put a $38 million cap on that transfer of funds in the middle of a housing crisis. $38 million, it sounds like a lot of money to me and you.
Well, to most people who think that's huge.
Right.
But in terms of what it will buy you.
What it will buy you is roughly probably maybe 300 units of housing.
And that's
a stretch.
That's presuming that you have infrastructure. That's presuming that you have land that's available.
Yes. Again, it's money that gets leveraged. In other words, that $38 million is not covering the total cost. That's the
gap. No, it's a bargaining chip.
Have. Yeah, it gets leveraged. The primary funding source that we have, that anyone who serves 60% and below, is the low-income housing tax credit program, which is both a federal program and a state program. That combination usually provides us with somewhere in the neighborhood of 40% of equity needed. Right. There's usually always a gap. Typically on a 100-unit project, we may have a $10 million gap. The gap is the amount of money needed in order to carry the debt on that property.
So I hear you saying that lawmakers have to understand what that cap has really done in forestalling any real movement on making some more of those affordable units. But beyond that, also understanding that there is a responsibility to do a lot more than what the rhetoric might suppose.
Exactly, because that funding alone from that source is definitely not enough. Each year, the governor also tries to put more money into the Rental Housing Revolving Fund using a capital improvement program. I believe this last year he asked for $40 million, and the fund received $25 million. The year before that, I believe he asked for $100 million. And the fund received $50 million. So that's on top of the $38 million that would be transferred. It's discouraging for us as housing advocates when the governor is trying. It's usually, even though I applaud the governor for his efforts, as a housing advocate, it needs to be 10 times that amount. Otherwise, we're never going to catch up to demand. It's just not going to happen. There's just too much demand out there. We're so far behind. One study, I believe, showed we're 16,000 units behind for 80% and below AMI. So typically we're building maybe 300 to 400 units per year with the funding that's available. Mm-hmm. So when you do the math, it's going to take us a long time. In the meantime, demand's going to increase because a lot of people want to live in Hawaii, not to mention the people who already live here.
This is not a happy story that you bring, but it really is a slice of reality that so many people experience. And I hope that when you are able to talk to lawmakers this week, that that will be perhaps better understood this time around. I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much. And we will try. We're constantly reminding them and trying to educate the new ones as to how we do business and how this all works so that they can understand better the need.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Kevin Carney is Vice President and Principal Broker of the Nonprofit Housing Corporation, EAH Hawaii. He's a certified National Affordable Housing Professional Executive, President of the Nonprofit Housing Hawaii, and has almost 40 years of real estate management and development experience in Hawaii. EAH currently has 1,800 affordable rental units under management on Oahu, Kauai, and Maui.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, Henry Kupono and Jerry Santos live in our studio. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we got to thinking about an organization Hawaii can be proud of, the Hawaii State Library System. It's the only statewide system in the United States and one of the largest. Its flagship building is Hawaii State Library in Honolulu on the grounds of Iolani Palace, and it's the subject of today's quiz. Before this historic structure was built, the Honolulu Library and Reading Room Association, founded in 1879 by the Kingdom of Hawaii, provided library facilities for Oahu. Neighbor islands were on their own, and in 1921, the county library law established separate libraries for the islands of Kauai, Maui, and Hawaii. The current system didn't come into being until statehood in 1959, and the downtown library remains the seat of its operations. That building opened in 1913, funded by a well-known philanthropist of the day, and this morning we're looking for his name. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right gets the Backyard Quiz tote bag that tells everybody you got it right.
Singer-songwriters aren't often heard in partnership with one another. Theirs is mostly an individual craft, but you can always expect an interesting result when they do collaborate. That's the premise behind Henry Kupono's ongoing artist-to-artist concert series, which brings him together with performers we don't usually get to hear him with. His next concert is with Jerry Santos, and both Henry and Jerry are with us in our studio. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Hi, mahalo.
Aloha. Good morning.
Henry, what was the germ of this idea with you?
The germ?
Well, that's probably not the best word I could have chosen.
We were all acknowledged at the Grammy Museum. So we had this big display, and my wife and I, my wife does my managing and stuff, and we were thinking, you know, it'd be so nice to carry this over and bring it to Hawaii. That whole concept of, you know, the iconic artists that have been the background for everybody's music.
Sure.
You know, life. And so we called Jerry. We also had Milani last month. We called Jerry and Keola Beamer, which mm-hmm. is next month, mm-hmm. and asked them if they'd be interested in doing something like this. And, you know, they all loved the idea. And really, the idea is really, it's about the artists. And in this case, it's about Jerry this week. Yeah. And I'm just there to talk story for a little bit, and then get him on his way to let people know about his music.
Yeah.
You know, where it came from, and a lot of things that happened back in those days that would interest people that grew up with our music.
Well, I think, as you said, it's kind of the soundtrack to our lives, yeah?
It is, yeah, it is.
Going back.
It was a good time for music, you know.
Yeah.
There was, there were artists, everybody had their own style. Everybody was had their own room or home,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of music going on back in those days, and everybody was writing their own songs.
So. But you had to choose on any given night whether to hear Henry or Jerry. Right?
Oh yeah, well, we never had the chance to go see each other because we're always playing, you know.
Exactly. Well, speaking of the soundtrack of our lives, the song that you folks are about to do is really a good example of that.
Oh yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Why don't you launch into it?
I have to say, though, that Henry Capono has always been this way. He has a very creative mind in creating opportunities and bringing everybody along with him.
Yeah.
We have always loved Henry for those reasons. And when he talked about this concert series particularly, it was inspiring to me because it was a time when people were being individual in the path that they were taking. And all four of the people that are included in this series approach things in a different way. And this is a chance to show where we came from and how it affected the path that we chose. This was my growing up song. I wrote this when I was 20 years old and escaped to see what the world was like. So I wrote this to my sister on a very cold night in San Francisco. I remember days when we were younger. We used to catch opu in the mountain stream. Round the Kolau hills we'd ride on horseback. So long ago, it seems it was a dream. Oh, yeah. Last night I dreamt I was returning, and my heart called out to you, but I fear I am not as I left you. Nike aloha ku. I remember days when we were smiling, when I laughed and sang the whole night long. And I will greet you as I find you, with the sharing of a brand new song. Last night I dreamt I was returning, and my heart called out to you, to please accept me as you'll find me. Miki aloha ku me o kahalu. Ke aloha ko me o kahalu. Ke aloha ko me o kahalu.
That was great, you guys. I think you demonstrated, Henry, just what a good idea that is.
Thank you.
That performance.
I've been really enjoying it, you know, because we get to dig into each other's life and see what we were doing back then. And,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of great things that happened back then. And, it's nice to share it with everybody.
Well, it was great to hear your song, Jerry.
Thank you.
With his voice.
Yeah. We've had a couple of chances to do that, actually. Yeah. So over the years, we also have some history together.
Sure.
Not only starting up in, well, Henry is getting well-known before we really had a chance to record, so that was always something to aim for.
Uh-huh.
But over the years, after my original partner, Robert Beaumont, passed away, Henry invited me out to sing with him and Brother Nolan, and that was a nice buffering part for me to regain some of my self-confidence. Mm-hmm. So over the years, he's popped up every once in a while to say, hold out a hand and say, come, let's talk stories. So this will be exciting.
Well, I think audiences don't really understand or know that much about the relationships that artists have with one another.
Behind the scenes, yes. They're very complex, and because we live in a small community, very nurturing, more nurturing than most people would expect.
Well, I think you also feel with fellow performers that nobody else really knows what that life is like, right? You're the only ones who are up at those hours of the night, for example.
Yeah, you know, we go through a lot. We go through a lot. You know, we're surrounded by a lot. And, you know, you're just a regular guy, and then all of a sudden, you know, you have everything around you. So, you know,
and yet you're the same guy you were last week, right?
Yeah, and you try just to keep your feet on the ground and make sure you make the right decisions and, you know, try to get this far, like today, you know. And
use those opportunities to benefit people in your community at the same time. So
exactly. That's where old friends come in handy. Yeah. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Hi, Mahalo.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Henry Capono and Jerry Santos will be performing at the Blue Note August 17th, that's Thursday this week, as part of Henry's Artist to Artist concert series.
Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
You may have been told that peeking into someone's pockets isn't nice, but you might make an exception when you're footing the bill for public servants. How much do we pay them? The updated CivilBeat Public Employee Salary Database has those answers, and CivilBeat Opinion Editor Chad Blair has the reality check. Hi, Chad.
Hi, Beth Ann.
So who's the top wage earner that we help pay for?
Well, it's not the University of Hawaii football coach, which has often been the case in the past. But Rolo, as we all call him, still is pulling down $400,000. That ranks him fourth, actually, at the University of Hawaii. There are three people ahead of him. The top earner is the med school dean, Jarris Hedges. He's making over $500,000. Avi Soifer, a friend of us, UH law professor, is next. And then David Lastner, the president, is actually third with $370,000-some. And it's all there, updated as of fiscal year 2018. That's the year that started July 1st.
So, Chad, how do those salaries compare to, say, other UH Manoa employees?
You know, there's actually 72 people at the University of Hawaii that make over $200,000 a year. That kind of struck me by surprise. I know that in order to remain competitive, the university does have to pay good bucks in order to get the right people. But then you also look at folks like, oh, you know, a general clerical worker, and their salary range is, well, far more modest. Starts around $23,000 up to about $37,000, $38,000 a year. So it really represents an enormous range, enormous diversity of the employees at UH.
Okay. Can we leave UH for a second and take a look at
sure.
healthcare? What happens there?
Well, it's interesting. The health systems, the hospital, the state hospital system, not the one that's in Kaneohe, but the system that includes hospitals on all the major islands. Remember, we just let some of those go. The Maui regional ones are now part of Kaiser. They always tend to rank very, very high in terms of payment, and such is the case this year. Let me drop a few other names. Ron Cochi, the Senate president, and Scott Sike, the House speaker, they're making about $69,000. Both of them get a little bit more than the regular senator and rep because, well, that's what they get for taking on these extra jobs. So,
okay, you
so
just shifted figures. Us to the Capitol. Let's talk some more about that. What about some of the watchdogs of what goes on to the Capitol?
Well, you know, the state auditor is on there, the ombudsman as well, far more modest salaries. If you're lucky if you do break six figures. And that's interesting that you mentioned that because they're watchdogs. Their job is to keep track of people, some of them that make much more money than they do, some that make much less. And those figures are up there as well. By the way, we don't have all the figures. We're still waiting, for example, for City Hall. We're going to get those hopefully pretty soon. Honolulu Hale, the Department of Education, we don't have those numbers as yet, but we're hoping to get those too very soon.
And so this is just going to be the update of the usual database that you put out roughly every 2 years?
Right. And if the numbers, if you look up somebody, a person or a title, and they're not listed in the 2018 database, which is right there on our homepage today, you can still look up the 2016 numbers. Those still exist as well in a database. By the way, I should also say, sometimes it's not a specific salary. Sometimes it's just a pay range that is listed to give you an indication of how much they make.
But the bottom line is you're going to get an idea of how much we spend on public servants and who's making a lot and who is making far less. Thanks, Chad.
You're welcome, Bethann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org, today featuring opinion editor Chad Blair. A Kauai study to track the amount of glyphosate in honey could have implications for humans. The research done over 2 years identified more of the chemical found in Roundup in honey taken from hives closer to sites where the pesticide is used. While the bees don't mind what's in their honey, people might. The World Health Organization has listed the chemical as a potential carcinogen in 2015. As of this past June, the Federal Drug Administration is again looking at how much glyphosate is turning up in U.S. food. James Trujillo is the chair of the Kauai Beekeepers Association and one of the study's researchers, and he joins us now by phone. Hello there.
Aloha, Beth Ann.
What made you decide to look at this study, and what was your hope for it?
Well, actually, I guess some clarification. I wasn't one of the researchers. I was just, if you will, a liaison between the researchers and the local beekeepers who wanted to participate in this study.
So weren't you out there gathering honey?
I was assisting as a member of the Kauai Beekeepers Association. I'm the chair, and we were approached by I also work for Kauai Community College, and through my work at the college, I'm based out of Kapaa High School, and one of the high school one of the high school science teachers contacted me and put me in touch with one of her students who was working with Dr. Carl Berg from Surfrider, and Ritika Kumar, who's now has graduated and she's attending school on the mainland. This was her second science project working with Surfrider. The first one dealt with pesticides in water, in public water sources. And so the second survey that they did wanted to find out the prevalence of Roundup in local honey. And so that's how I got involved, and I ended up recruiting beekeepers as well as helping Ritika and Carl collect samples from different hives and different locations.
You did this over a period of, what, 18 months or so?
Yeah, so it was a fairly long project for Ritika. She actually started her junior year and finished it up her senior year.
Now that she is off to college, are you looking at being able to take the study farther, and what would you hope to do?
Well, actually, Dr. Carl Berg did do a second study to find whether those first results were an abnormality or if that was kind of consistent with what they found in the second survey. And to the dismay of others, the results were pretty similar. So Dr. Carl Berg now is looking to do this on other islands, and we're in the midst of negotiations or dialogue, I guess is probably a better way of putting it, with the State Department of Agriculture. The apiary section has done a similar test, but that what they were looking at was pesticides that would be found in pollen. And so Ritika and Dr. Berg's study was really specific. They were looking at Roundup in honey, and what the Department of Agriculture was looking at was just what types of chemicals would we find in honeybee pollen. And we were surprised again. The numbers were much higher than anybody anticipated. In fact, according to Department Chair Scott Enright, every sample, I think there was 23 samples, came back positive with some sort of pesticide. Most of them domestic use, commonly used household products,
James,
were found in our.
I wanted to interrupt you for a second there because, you know, when people hear that the pesticides are turning up in honey, and we've already seen other studies showing that it's turning up in food of all different types, is there any safe tolerant limit that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has for glyphosate?
My understanding, there is none, and that was one of the things that came up when because Dr. Carl Berg and Ritika's project started just right before the state commenced their study, and there was some discussions about trying to maybe marry, blend the two studies to be able to work with the same beekeepers and look for two different things. One of the issues was that the state didn't want to sample the honey because if there were contaminants in that honey, they might have to condemn that honey crop. And for glyphosate, for Roundup, there is no tolerance that's been listed by FDA or EPA. I'm not sure which is the regulatory body that sets those tolerant limits, but for Roundup, there was none for honey.
What about elsewhere in the world, say the European Union?
Now, this is a good question that I'm not aware of what those limits are. This is somewhat that recently have scientists and consumer food groups been looking at the amount of Roundup, where the levels are and how prevalent are those findings. And it seems like it's pretty consistent across the board that there are ways that this Roundup product is making its way into the hives.
Well, I mean, it seems in a way logical that if you're talking about a crop that flowers and bees are coming to that crop where it's flowering and perhaps Roundup has been used, that might indicate by the honey samples that you've taken that there would be more of the glyphosate residue in the honey closer to the places where the Roundup's being used.
And that was Dr. Berg's finding, was that in areas where there was large agricultural activity, as well as proximity to whether it was roads or golf courses, to known areas where weed control is an issue, and Roundup being the preferred product of many, that those application sites have somehow drifted into local apiaries.
Has there been any conversations with, you know, toxicologists in the state?
Not that I'm aware of.
So, go ahead. No,
well, I'm just saying this is something that as beekeepers became aware, the study done by Surf Rider and Dr. Carl Berg, beekeepers were notified of their results. with the State Department of Agriculture, there was a preliminary notification. And then midway through the study, there was, and I'm not quite sure of the issues that came up because we haven't gotten information from the state about this. There was, if you will, kind of a a stop on information being shared from the department with local beekeepers.
So we have to go into a second, but I want to ask you, are you concerned then about the, you know, the honey products that you're selling and what might be in them and what might this mean for your business and for other beekeepers?
Oh, absolutely. This has definitely been a study that didn't leave us with good results, although one of the local papers did share that the state results confirm that our bees are healthy and that there's no issues. I think beekeepers feel differently about that, and that there are some unresolved issues and some questions that have been left unanswered.
Well, we hope you get answers to those soon. Certainly, everyone who would like to see healthy bee populations, but also healthy products made from them. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
James Trujillo is the chair of the Kauai Beekeepers Association and manages 30 hives in several apiaries on the Garden Island. In 2009, he helped found the KCC Bee Lab and teaches apiary classes through the Community College's Office of Continuing Education and works full-time with KCC's Construction Academy at Kapaa High School.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii. Walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki. Providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. AmazingUrgentCare.com. Stargazer time. What's happening in our dark island skies and also what's going on in the massive universe around our tiny planet. And as usual, we're turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips and welcoming him back right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's happening this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers, Jupiter and Saturn can be seen in the southwestern sky throughout the night. Jupiter will be setting at around 9:43 p.m., followed by Saturn at 1:32 a.m. The moon will be waning this week.
And you have some exciting news, I understand, that relates to the Mauna Kea summit and also a discovery of a number of planets around a nearby star.
Indeed. The W.M. Keck Observatory atop Mauna Kea was used by an international team to discover several planets orbiting a nearby star that is quite similar to our own sun. The system is called Tau Ceti, and this most recent discovery is of four worlds that could be a little larger and heavier than our own Earth. These planets are thought to lie in the habitable zone.
So this is the Goldilocks zone, where there could be liquid water potential for life.
It is, yes. Planets can be found at all distances around stars. The ones we're most interested in lie in between, at a distance that is comparable to our own Earth, not too hot or not too cold. And as you said, in the words of Goldilocks, it is just right.
Liquid water, a prerequisite for life to exist.
It is, and that's why we try to find these planets in other habitable zones that may look like ours.
And I thought it was almost impossible to find these small Earth-like worlds. What's changed in our approach?
You're right. It's been very, very difficult. But the team that made this discovery used a method called the radial velocity technique to find these planets. They watched the Tau Ceti star wobble as the planets orbited around it. You can imagine this like the hammer thrower at the Olympics. As he swings the hammer round and round, he also wobbles around a common center of mass. The same thing happens when planets go around a star. The more massive the planet, the bigger the wobble.
And then they can detect from the movement the approximate size of the planet.
That's absolutely right. Up until now, we've only been able to detect really big planets like Jupiter, but we're getting closer and closer to finding smaller planets like our own Earth.
And possibly having some nice, cool, clear water waiting for us.
I would like to think so.
It's Christopher Phillips and another enlightening Stargazer report. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we talked about the Hawaii State Library building in downtown Honolulu, the seat of the country's only statewide library system. It's just up the street from Iolani Palace and is on the U.S. National Register of Historic Places. Groundbreaking for the building, designed by architect Henry Whitfield, took place in 1911. Construction was completed in 1913. Extensive renovation in 1930 tripled the size of the facility with its large open courtyard and added wings designed by architect C.W. Dickey. Additional improvements were made between 1990 and 1992, and today the facility is heavily used. We asked you the name of the main philanthropist who paid for construction, and it was Andrew Carnegie, who ponied up $100,000.
And Jesse Weinberger called us from Eva Beach and got it right, as did all of the callers who phoned in today. But Jesse was first and gets the prize. If you've got a backyard quiz question for us, you can always send it in to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
The Hawaii International Film Festival's theme in its inaugural year of 1981 was When Strangers Meet, and it has been bringing together disparate elements of the cinematic world ever since. It has a long track record of bringing previously unknown works, particularly from Asia, to the screen. Its new executive director, Becky Stocchetti, says one of the festival's most valuable contributions has been as an incubator of talent.
What has been really amazing to watch over the growth of HIFF as a festival altogether is watching actual filmmakers evolve through the process. We've brought filmmakers in, you know, the 90s when they were just starting out. Mm-hmm. And now in 2015, 16, and this current year, we're giving awards for lifetime achievement or the evolution of their craft. Mm-hmm. And filmmakers from Asia that are now working in Hollywood.
You know, when you look at films through the decades, mm-hmm. if you were shown a film made in the 70s, you would know right away that it was made in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
80s, same thing, mm-hmm. right? And yet, nobody seems to know exactly at the time what those criteria are. I mean, in some ways, these things evolve on their own, don't you think?
I think it's a combination of mass audience appeal, right? And I think we're seeing and we're bringing films from Hollywood and Europe and China and different parts of Asia that are specifically crafted for mass audience appeal. And then there are films that are more thoughtful or doing new interesting things with technology, yeah. with storytelling, coming out of all different parts of the world. And that is what HIFF is bringing to the table that makes it such a unique festival. We're showing these entertaining and thoughtful films that are really cutting edge and innovative.
You know, technology has changed so much about storytelling, but it doesn't preclude its being a technologically driven, thoughtful film, right?
Correct.
Is that happening more and more, you think?
I think what HIFF is really leveraging right now is the access to media has made storytelling a lot more possible for different people in different parts of society.
Right.
And what we're seeing is, in addition to an inundation of new stories and new voices, a more competitive, higher caliber level of that storytelling. People are having to hone their craft to stand out from the crowd. And what our programmers are doing and what HIFF is really bringing to audiences in Hawaii are those new storytellers, those new voices that are really honing their craft in new and interesting and exciting ways.
So competition is sort of heating up, right?
It is, but also what's really exciting is that so many more different types of stories are accessible to audiences now. I think what we're going to show you in this year HIFF's Fall Festival and then in future years is that we're shining spotlights on different types of voices. So looking more closely at Pacific Islanders and Hawaii filmmakers, now that we have the spotlight that HIFF has cultivated over 37 years on an international level, and these filmmakers coming out of the Pacific Rim that are working at that same caliber as the filmmakers coming out of Asia and Hollywood and really showcasing and celebrating that in a very exciting way.
What do you think has brought local filmmakers to that level technically?
A huge variety of things. There are so many resources on a local level. the Academy for Creative Media at UH Manoa, which we partner with and show our student showcase, Pacific Islanders and Communication, their continuing workshops. We also partner with them. And DBET, their continuing commitment to developing creative talent in Hawaii, as you see through the film festival as part of our Sound and Vision program and Creative Lab. So many resources are available to people in Hawaii and the Pacific Islands now. And also for HIF's part in that, you know, we are every year bringing, we're bringing renowned talent and people who are experts in the field to Hawaii to have those types of conversations with the industry here. And we are continuing to be committed to doing that, working with the local industry and providing them access to Hollywood and Europe and Asia in a much bigger way.
Well, you point up, by just talking about the people that you've brought out here, you remind me that this is a, you know, filmmaking in its early years was solely taught by apprenticeship, right? You had to be on the set. Only then could you know all the little secrets, as you have learned yourself, right?
I have, yeah. My career started in production, working mostly in documentary film, and then has progressed most recently on the facilitation side, working at the City of Chicago Film Office with all the different independent and national films that were coming through that city. What is exciting about HIF and how we play a really vital role in that is our different education programs. In addition to partnering with the amazing resources that are in Hawaii, we have our own education programs as far as bringing filmmakers to different schools across the island and on Kauai and in the Big Island. And then also, you know, we have our direct mentorship as well through our Young Writers Program, where we are teaching youth about media literacy and actually having them learn how to think critically and then articulate that about film.
It's hard to stay ahead of students in the whole field of media literacy because it'll change by next week, right?
But that's what's so exciting about it.
Yeah, well, I agree.
And students are, I mean, that's the future. Those are our future storytellers.
Yeah.
And so what they're experiencing and how they're able to translate that on film or in writing is going to be the next piece of our culture. And, you know, in my earlier years with HIF, I worked on the education side and the community engagement side of the festival. And I saw more talent coming out of some schools in Hawaii that are working with really interesting virtual reality, augmented reality, very cutting edge new ways of telling their stories that's going to set them apart from the current generation. And that's what it's all about.
It bodes really well for the future, doesn't it?
It does. I think that, you know, people, it's so easy now to get sucked down into some of the rhetoric and into some of the conversations that we are all inundated with in the news. And in reality, the perspective that the film festival brings is, you know, the celebration of the real stories that people are telling. I think that sound bites can divide people, but stories can bring people together.
Yeah.
And that's what HIF is all about. And that's why supporting the festival is so important.
Becky Stocchetti is the executive director of the Hawaii International Film Festival, whose fall showcase will run November 2nd through the 12th. A lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us at this point in the show every day for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar, one of them being the artwork of over 250 keiki.
I know. That's a lot of keiki.
That is, certainly is.
It's on Maui through next week. This exhibition showcases the work of youth taking part in Hui No'eau Visual Arts Center's summer programs, and the result is a display of creativity that celebrates visual arts education for the youth in our community. And the exhibit's on display through August 24th at Hui No'eau Visual Arts Center in Makaua'u.
Hey, anything that promotes arts education mm-hmm. for kids, right?
Yes. Definitely.
And you can learn how to buy a home at a workshop in Waipahu.
Yes, the Matanuska Valley FCU in Waipahu presents a free workshop titled Successful Home Ownership. And you can gain knowledge in the home buying process while learning what's needed to secure the best loan available. This workshop is tomorrow from 6:30 to 7:30 in the Royal Kunia Community Rec Center. You can reserve seats by calling the phone number that's on our website.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. And the Kona Book Club has got a monthly meeting, which is tomorrow.
It is tomorrow, and the book club meets on the lanai of the Kailua Kona Public Library. Now, this month's selection is called Honor Killing by David Stannard. And once again, it's tomorrow at 11 a.m. on the lanai of the Kailua Kona Library.
That whole book club phenomenon has really grown over the years. It's great to see.
Mm-hmm,
thanks a lot, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
And that's going to do it for us as we're coming up to the top of the hour. But no fear, we'll be back with you tomorrow morning or tomorrow, anytime you're going to listen to us. We'll be talking about the ACA rate hikes requested by HMSA and Kaiser Permanente. We'll be talking with Insurance Commissioner Gordon Ito.
And we'll be looking at the last days of Judas Iscariot at UH.
If you have something you want to say, you can let us know by email. That address is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, or you can post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can find me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll be back with you tomorrow for a lot more of The Conversation.